The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. I'm here with Tora Katcher, world-traveling, sports-playing super geek who doubles as a university professor. In between exploring the planet and warping young scientists' minds, she completed her PhD from the University of Alberta in developmental genetics and is currently a lecturer of cell biology and genetics at the University of Alberta and Grant MacEwan University. She also writes, produces, and hosts science videos on her website, Science in Seconds. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Tora.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So I attended the Pure Spec Science Fiction and Fantasy Convention here in Edmonton a few months ago, and you were there doing a presentation on the science of superpowers.
Yes, I was. It was very exciting.
Well, that's not exactly a new presentation topic in the science outreach community, but you had a really interesting spin on it. You went over some of the more popular potential superpowers and explained whether you'd be more likely to get those powers via genetics or through technological advantages, let's say. So why did you decide to talk about it that way?
Well, one of the things we know about superpowers is that a lot of them are, there's a plausibility to them, because I think we get them inspired from other aspects of biology, whether it's wall crawling in the spider, obviously, or the gecko. And so there's this inspiration that comes from biology. And I think that a lot of the technology that is based on those comes from the biological inspiration. And so you want to sort of pair those and almost have them compete with each other. Is it what is more likely to obtain super strength via some biological mechanism or via some technological mechanism? So we compare them, I guess, compare and contrast them that way.
Since you mentioned super strength, let's start with that. So what would be the genetics-based way to get that?
Well, it's interesting because we humans have a limit on how much muscle they can actually build and still maintain our skeleton the way it is, because we can fracture our own bones if we get too strong. And so there's this biological limitation that way. But there are people that have been now recently identified in the last couple of years that have shown this, what we consider to be super strength. And there's one individual, he's about 7 years old, called Liam Hoekstra, and he was a Michiganian, I think that's how you say it. And he was born as a toddler, and as a toddler displayed incredible strength, the ability to do sit-up after sit-up after sit-up, to hold a pull-up, and things that, you know, the average toddler can't do. And so a various medical community got a hold of him, started doing tests and figuring out where this came from. And it was shown that he actually has a deficiency in a receptor and in the cell signaling that controls how much muscle you actually build. So he has no break on how much muscle he produces. And there's been a couple of individuals that have now been identified with this, what's called muscular hypertrophy, where you have way more muscle than average. And so he displays the super strength. And in fact, it's something that has been bred into cattle and racing dogs for quite a while, obviously cattle being something they call double muscling. And so it's hugely valuable for the beef industry when you have one cow with double the meat on it. And they've done a lot of the genetics of it to find out that it's a defect in usually in a gene called myostatin. And that's, again, this sort of normal break to stop how much muscle you produce. And if you're lacking that, then you end up with way more muscle cells and way more muscle fibers than a normal human.
So at this point, could we actually sort of reproduce that in humans, that effect?
There's definitely a push now as we discover more and more for treatments for things like muscular dystrophies and any progressive muscle weakening diseases. If we can somehow stop or induce, I guess, more muscle than is normally supposed to be there. The myostatin itself, just applying it, if you know there's wannabe Olympic athletes out there, you can't just take a supplement of myostatin and expect it to work, or a myostatin inhibitor. But there is certainly a huge pharmacological push to hopefully treat some of these, again, muscle weakening diseases.
Now, how about the other route? How could we get super strong through technology?
Well, yeah, because humans are limited by our skeleton and breaking, there is the sort of push to, and this is largely from the military, and a lot of the technological advances are, of course, from the military to create super strong soldiers. And there's been a couple of companies that have developed these exoskeletons. And so what these are is literally normally the soldier, the person steps into a crazy metallic apparatus where you almost hold on to controllers. And this is just a really souped up, almost Wii. And you step into it and it translates your movements with electronic movements. And so you can basically, the stuff that they've developed, you have about 10 times more strength than the average human would. So you can lift 2,000 pounds and relatively easily. And so they've developed a couple, and there's a couple companies working towards this, largely funded by DARPA, but there's also a Japanese company who's interested in doing it, and it made a little bit of press a while ago called the HAL 5.
Right.
And they originally marketed it towards nurses, so they could do a lot of the heavy lifting of patients when they're not necessarily the strongest, you know, people, they don't need orderlies to do it, where the nurses could just dip into this little almost robot skeleton and start moving people around. And they're actually hoping to market it relatively within the year.
So is that still pretty unwieldy at this point, though?
Well, the issue right now with the exoskeletons is largely the power that it requires and obviously the cost. But powering these devices and requiring a portable battery pack or some sort of recharge station has made it a little bit less tangible from a military perspective, which is doing the majority of the funding.
Okay, next up, invisibility. Now, technology has made some amazing strides in this area quite recently, correct?
Yes, absolutely. There's actually for invisibility in this, you know, Harry Potter invisibility cloak idea, there's actually made incredible advances in the last year. And there's three real strategies to become invisible and have some invisibility material. And the most recent one that was just in last October was something called carbon nanotubes. And this was developed by the University of Texas at Dallas. And what these carbon nanotubes are, nanotubes is referring to the 1/1,000,000th of a meter thick. And what it is mimicking a mirage that you'd see in the desert. And so what happens is that the heat from the sun, in the case of the mirage, bends the light in a way that you're actually seeing, of course, a reflection of the sky, which we interpret as water. So what they're doing with these nanotube strategy is to superheat this structure and have it bend the light in a way that basically shadows or overcomes anything that you see. And so you see a reflection of what you are originally seeing. And so it looks like an invisibility cloak. It's not particularly feasible. They're heating the material, this nanotube material, to 2,300 degrees Celsius. So it's not something you'd maybe want to wear if you wanted to be invisible. But it's really good for working potentially underwater. So as invisible submarines are potentially something that could happen relatively soon. The second strategy is something called metamaterials. And these are just tiny little structures usually made of gold or copper and silver. And what they do is they have a negative index of refraction. So they bend light in the opposite way you'd expect that normal structures do. And they're tiny little structures that are smaller than the wavelength of light. So if you're not a physicist, what ends up happening is that light bends around the object instead of reflecting back. And so it's a sort of analogous to a rock in a stream, that the water goes around the rock but then comes back together at the other side and is not basically disrupted. And if you do that at the speed of light, you're effectively looking around the object without ever seeing it. And the third one, which is something that has crazy YouTube videos, is called optical camouflage. Imagine having a camera in front of you and then recording what's going on behind you. And so you just project what's going on behind you in front, and so you end up, it looks like you're looking through you. It's not, again, particularly feasible at this point just because of the amount of power that's involved, but it certainly ends up with really cool invisibility cloak kind of images. But really at this point, it's the metamaterials, that second strategy, that's getting the most excitement for a real plausible way to hide buildings, hide yourself, whatever you want to be invisible.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, and my guest is Tara Katcher, lecturer of cell biology and genetics at the University of Alberta and Grant MacEwan University. So we've talked about how to potentially reach invisibility through technology. So how about genetics?
Well, genetics, from the human perspective, it's not really possible, partly because we carry oxygen in our blood using heme, which is iron. So it has a pigment. So technically, albino people are actually lacking pigment in their skin and transparent. However, just the layers of organs doesn't make us invisible. So transparency is one actual way to become truly invisible, the way a sort of a jellyfish would do. But there's some really interesting other biological strategies that maybe humans aren't capable of. But something like the cuttlefish or the octopus is a perfect example. They can change the color and pigment of their skin through neural networks. So they can actually think their skin different colors and textures by changing cells called chromatophores and changing what pigments are actually expressed or sort of opened and shown and those things. And humans only have one type of chromatophore called a melanocyte. So we probably can't genetically engineer that anytime soon, but it at least gives the possibility of incredibly accurate camouflage as a form of invisibility.
But really, there's no gene therapy way?
Not for us yet.
That's sad.
That's one thing that we're going to have to rely on technology for.
Okay, well, my favorite of the ones that you discussed is regeneration. So again, other species have this down, but why don't we? Why don't humans regenerate naturally?
Well, part of regeneration, then the problem with it is it's sort of inversely proportional to complexity. It's a lot easier to regenerate a simple structure than a complex structure like the human hand. And so we do have the capacity early as an embryo to regenerate any possible organ. And those are embryonic stem cells. And we call them pluripotent in that they can technically form any possible cell in the body. But as we develop, we need more and more specialized cells. And you don't need a heart cell in your toe. So you restrict the potency of those individual cells. So we do have the capacity at some point, at least genetic capacity, to generate anything. We just have to find ways to tease out, in a way, some of the programming that's happened through development. So that brings to the technological side, which is what they're doing now. And there's been limitations recently, but of inducing taking skin cells or some other easily recognizable cell and doing something called dedifferentiation, which means you remove the sort of programmer, the decisions that have been made by introducing a set of four genes, and those turn on and off different programs to revert back to a more pluripotent or embryonic-like state. And then from there, the goal is to add chemicals in a certain order, mimicking development, to eventually develop all sorts of different cells in the body and potentially different limbs and organs.
So this is really a combination of genetics and technology.
Yeah, we definitely are manipulating our own genetic capacity, which is already there, but using our technological advances and our knowledge to really change the genetic expression pattern, change the genes that are turned on and off so that we can do all sorts of things. And they've grown human bladders in culture. They're looking at an artificial heart has been done for a rat, not an artificial, but a stem cell generated heart that has been differentiated in a rat as well.
So what else could we potentially do with stem cells then? Could we actually regenerate any part of our body then?
Yes, technically we could regenerate any part of our body. And that's the promise of stem cells in general. And so this is neural stem cells. I mean, any possible thing that goes through a developmental cascade we can do, because it's that information's already there. The problem with the technology at this point is that one of the features of tumor cells is dedifferentiation. So if we're basically giving tumors right now a leg up, we're giving them that one step that they need to develop. So we have to be really careful about dedifferentiating or removing the programming and then reprogramming them these cells in a permanent way so they don't revert back to this sort of early stage that can easily develop tumors.
So how far are we away with something like this? Because I don't want to be hyperbolic, but really the potential in this area makes it pretty hard not to be.
Absolutely. And they're, the stuff that they're doing right now, down in, actually in Texas as well, they're looking at, they've developed a, human bladder. They're doing these crazy experiments where they take stem cells and they literally, with a paintbrush, paint the cells onto a scaffold or like a framework, and then treat them with a certain amount of chemicals that we, that these differentiation factors, and they change their fate and they change their program to develop these different organs. So in theory, the great part about stem cells is that they come from you. So there's no fear of immune rejection or anything like that. They're just your cells taken out for a little bit, grown in a lab, and then put back into you. So kidney replacement, liver, all the different probably neuronal cells that go on in your brain, they're all technically possible. Absolutely. How soon is it? The simple organs, bladder for sure. They've done penile structures. They've done some eye cells to a certain extent and skin. And so there's some things that are easy to do. Blood is easy to make from scratch, basically. But it's still in its infancy because the potential is so huge.
Okay, last one. Super sight. So how? Through tech. Let's start with tech.
Cool. So tech is a couple of things. With super sight, you have the ability to manipulate the wavelength of light coming in and the information, and that's using infrared goggles, UV goggles, and so those kinds of things that we see, like night vision goggles. And all that is usually changing what frequency of light and what wavelength you're sensitive to. There's also this blend of bio and tech here, because a couple of years ago, they managed to genetically engineer a monkey to carry a new gene for a color vision that it doesn't normally have. And so the eye is an actually really accessible organ. So they introduced the genes directly into the eye, and those eye cells, the retinal cells, started producing a pigment sensing cell that wasn't normally there. So we have this gene out there, and this is red-green color, and you can add it to a monkey, which is basically a furry human, and you can add it to the monkey, and then it can grow these new cells, this new sensory system, and also interpret those new signals in the brain and process them. So whether we have genes for UV light, like in some insects, or infrared spectra, in theory, the technology is all there to reintroduce a new gene from a different species and be able to actually see those new wavelengths.
So this is potentially transferable to humans.
This is definitely transferable to humans, and I don't know who's working on it, but I'm sure someone is somewhere.
But again, animals are ahead of us in certain areas. Some species do have this power, don't they?
Yeah, so bees can see in the UV spectrum. A lot of birds of prey can see in the infrared. So it's just a matter of manipulating those genes. The nocturnal animals often have a reflective coating on the inner sort of face of the eye to bounce back more light. So light's reflected off of the retina and you lose a lot of that information. They bounce it back a second time so they can see much, much, much more detail with really low light levels. So the super sight out there is incredible in the, from the biological spectrum.
Now, is there any way to splice bee genes with our genes to get that kind of sight?
Yes. Yes, there is. You take the part that encodes the protein and you add some human characteristics to the gene. And in theory, yeah, it's absolutely possible.
That really blows my mind. the fact that we can do things like this.
Yeah.
What kind of time period are we legitimately talking about for these kinds of superpowers?
I suppose it would depend. I mean, the thing with manipulating the biological side, you have to end up going through a lot more red tape. So that's a little bit less likely to have humans volunteering for UV vision genetically spliced into them.
Right.
But the technological side, some of them, invisibility cloak is quite near, certainly with one of the techniques. The exoskeleton is, they're hoping to use it within the year in hospitals. So some of this is happening. It's out there.
The future is now, people.
Absolutely.
Tora, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much.
We've included links to Tora Catcher and her site, Science in Seconds, on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back to talk to the author of The Vision Revolution, Mark Changizi, after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
I'm here with Mark Changizi. Mark is the director of human cognition at the Research Institute 2 AI Labs. He has a PhD in math from the University of Maryland, and in 2002, he won a prestigious Sloan Swartz Fellowship in Theoretical Neurobiology from Caltech. He's also the author of three books, The Brain from 25,000 Feet, Harnessed, How Language and Music Mimic Nature and Transformed Ape to Man, and the 2009 book, The Vision Revolution, How the Latest Research Overturns Everything We Thought We Knew About Human Vision. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Glad to be here.
So before we get into the details, I kind of want to lay the groundwork for this. Now, first of all, can you explain what a theoretical neuroscientist actually does?
I'm interested in study of why the brain, and often the body, is structured the way it is, why we see the way we do, why your body is structured the way it is. So why do animals have as many limbs as they do, or why do your fingers get pruny when they're wet, or why do you see illusions in the manner that we see them? And these why questions have to be answered in a very different way than when you're looking at the how questions about the billiard balls that are in the head or in the body and the sequences of the mechanisms. So instead of studying the mechanisms, I'm wondering why do we have mechanisms that do those sorts of functions rather than other sorts of functions? And these are evolutionary questions. They're design questions about why did we get designed this way? And to answer that, you have to come up with typically some kind of hypothesis about what function the animal has evolved or been selected to carry out. And to test it, you have to go out and you either have to make predictions about, well, if it really is designed for this, you should expect this sort of structure. And if it really is designed for this, you should expect that animals in that kind of ecology shouldn't have this or that. And so you can make various kinds of predictions, but it's a different thing than when you're going and making predictions about the specific mechanism in one brain.
Well, now today we're talking about vision. So how much of our brains exactly are devoted to vision?
About half. So nearly half of the brain is involved in or associated with vision in some way or another.
And you point out in your book that not only is sight such a huge part of our brains, it's also maybe the best understood of all the senses.
It's more amenable to understanding in a couple senses. One, we can consciously think about it in ways. So, for example, smell, it may be that there's less of our brain that's devoted to it and it's older, but the number of dimensions that's involved in olfaction is potentially thousands of different kinds of specialized neurons that are involved in different kinds of odors in the world, different kinds of, and we don't know how to even build a space or to think or talk about what it is that perceptual world is about. So visual perception, we can sort of talk about, oh yeah, well, there's objects and there's the way that those objects project towards the eye, and then there's colors and the spectra. So we both on the theoretical side, we can talk about what those perceptions are, and on the brain side, it turns out that it's been possible to unpack it. There's a dozen or so hierarchical levels. There's two entirely sort of different hierarchical levels in your brain that help unpack what you see and give you the ability to see different kinds of objects and interpret the world and how to move within it.
Is there a currently accepted explanation for why vision evolved the way it did?
Packed in that, of course, is 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 specific ways that it evolved. And one wouldn't be able to give an explanation for why vision evolved the way it did. One would be able to give specific explanations for specific facets. So why we see in color or in the way that particular kind of color vision that we have and so forth. So for any specific fashion in which we see or way in which we see, then the hope is that one can hopefully explain why it is that we see that way.
And that's exactly what your book is about, really. And you mentioned a few minutes ago that you're more interested in the why vision evolved as opposed to how. Why is that?
That's a good question. I could come up with some really attempt at an intellectual answer. So some of it may just be personality type at the end of the day, and it really would be just telling stories. To me, it feels like a more fundamental question to ask, what is the function that the brain is designed to carry out? And certainly it's also important to eventually figure out what are the mechanisms that have been selected for to implement those functions, to implement those powers or capabilities. But very often, and so all of this has to be done by science. You need to figure out what specifically the brain is actually doing billiard ball-wise in your head. But, of course, you can't understand that unless you also understand the kind of thing that the brain is trying to do. And if you're interested in building artificial intelligence, you're ultimately only interested in one of those. You're interested in what is the brain trying to actually do. Forget about how it goes about doing it.
Right.
Because if you can just figure out what the brain is trying to do, then you can build artificial brains to mimic just hell or high water, have it come up with some mechanism to carry out the same function the brain carries out, and we don't care if it's a very different mechanism.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Mark Changizi, Director of Human Cognition at 2AI Labs and author of The Vision Revolution, How the Latest Research Overturns Everything We Thought We Knew About Human Vision. Now, your book looks at the evolution of vision, particularly in primates, and you propose an explanation that's actually pretty different from the way that it's been described before. And you explain your theories in terms of superpowers, which you've mentioned a couple of times. So you say that primate vision is sort of a collection of four superpowers. We have telepathy, X-ray vision, future seeing, and spirit reading. But you're not talking about these as literal superpowered abilities, right?
No, and I don't think primate vision is a collection of those four. These are really four different areas of our functionality that I happen to have research on, and they cover four different areas of sort of the standard four areas of vision. The idea is that there's a sense in which it's, of course, a joke that we have superpowers, but on the other hand, there's another sense in which, well, part of us wouldn't even want to count it as superpowers if it's not magic. I mean, there's some intuition we have. If it ain't magic, it's not superpowers. But, you know, and it's certainly part of the game in Star Trek that there really are underlying scientific stories which may explain why, for example, Deanna Troi in The Next Generation can read the thoughts of these other people. There's something about her brain that evolved differently. And in the case of color, my argument is that the kinds of cones that we have in our eyes that receive color, spectral information from the world, have in fact been designed to be optimally sensitive or near optimally sensitive to the kinds of skin spectral modulations that occur on the skin of other primates. And in our cases, you know, for humans in particular, is all we really care about. And so we really have, on the external parts of our body, our receptors have in fact been designed specialized for sensing the emotions on other creatures, emotions and states and moods. That sounds like, you know, emotional telepathy or Deanna Troi-like behavior in some sense. And here we've had this all along. Does that count as a superpower? It sounds like a real-world superpower in a sense, and a highly efficient one that was designed and evolved over tens of millions of years.
But haven't we assumed for a long time that color vision evolved to aid in foraging?
Yeah, so for 100 years, the standard hypothesis for color vision was that it had to do with basically food. And it was either fruit, and then much more recently the thought was it could be ripe leaves. One of the main difficulties with the hypothesis in terms of having the power to explain the kinds of the fairly specific kind of color vision that we primates who have color vision have is that we have tremendously varied diets across the primates. There's tremendous variability in the kinds of diets that we have, and yet we all end up with the same kind of color vision amongst the old world primates that have color vision. So you have tremendous food diversity, but it's very similar kind of color vision. Why would we have such that one kind of color vision, which is not well optimized for any of that kind of variability? But, of course, one of the things that these primates that have the same kind of color vision that also share and also have the exact same thing is the same skin. They, of course, have different baseline skin colors, but what matters is not the baseline skin color of the primate or the human, but how that modulates as a function of more or less blood under the skin and more or less oxygenated hemoglobin. And that's the same no matter what kind of primate you are. So that's why you want the same kind of color vision no matter what kind of primate you are.
We have a question from the chat room from Josh.
What research is there that shows that primate eyes are extremely sensitive to skin color changes? How dependent is it on background skin color? Has there been enough evolutionary time to optimize this for non-furry hominids?
So this is, starting with the last question, so this is something that's not just for humans. It goes back 20, 30 million years to all the old world primates. And one of the things that you find amongst the primates that have color vision is that the primates with color vision are also the primates that have bare skin. The primates that don't have color vision also tend to be furry-faced, just like your typical mammal. So it's not a new thing with humans at all. It's a new thing with primates and nakedness, in some sense. Nakedness on the face, nakedness on the rump, often nakedness on the chest. It's also true that, you know, when you look at your, if you can see this with your veins. When you look at your veins, you see greenish blue, or, you know, you see these green veins there, and you're inclined to say that they're green. This is to the first part of the question, which is something along the lines of, is it required to see it against the baseline of skin? The interesting thing about the skin color changes is that even though you look at your veins and you say they're green, if you were to look at those green veins with an aperture, like looking through a straw, and you rigged it so that you could make sure that when you're looking through that straw, you were only looking at your veins and not any of the surrounding skin, those veins are actually skin colored. That is, they're slightly shifted toward green. But when you have something that's slightly shifted towards green on a background of what was the baseline skin color, you perceive it as just green. Now, is it really green or not green? You can sort of ask philosophical questions. Perceptually, it's green, but it's not very green. It's effectively seen all by itself. It would just be what effectively you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between it and your baseline skin color. So when you blush, it's not that your whole body shifts. It's that you end up with these gradients, like on your face. You end up with some parts that are red, but it's always some parts because the other parts are not changing. It's only that contrast, the difference between the subtle changes relative to the baseline, that makes it very perceptible and very sensible, sensitive to see. When people get sick, if they have central cyanosis, it's called, and suddenly their whole body becomes deoxygenated much more uniformly, it's much more dangerous because their whole skin is shifting. And maybe it happens a little bit faster on the lips or some other places, but if it happens much more uniformly, and which means that you can't really see that it's happening at all with your bare eyes because it's all uniformly shifting. But the signals that are designed to be seen, these color signals, are typically having gradients that allow it to be seen relative to other skin.
And the first part of his question, again, was what research exists to show that primate eyes are extremely sensitive to skin color changes?
The research is what... You can work out on the basis of how oxygenation, in fact, modulates. You could ask, what kinds of cones would we have to be optimally sensitive to those subtle shifts of oxygenation? That is, what kinds of cones do you need to be maximally sensitive to that kind of change, that red-green change due to oxygenation? And the kinds of cone receptivities that we have are, in fact, optimized to be able to see that. That's the argument. It's not new news that humans and primates are sensitive to the butts and facial colorations, that we can see these things. What was surprising is that the signature of design for seeing these things is in the sensitivity of the cone sensitivities in the eye.
And we have another question from the chat from Ironside.
Is there any evolutionary benefit to those of us whose color vision is impaired?
I think there could be, but I don't have an answer to it. Amongst old world primates and humans in particular, there's a noticeable asymmetry between those with dichromacy, with just missing the red-green sense, and the rest of us who have so 10%-ish of males don't have color vision at all in the sense of what we usually mean, whereas effectively no women lack it. It's something like 0.5% or something, very small. So that's one asymmetry. And then amongst females, you end up with these tetrachromats. They end up with an extra cone with a different sensitivity in that same region. Whether it actually makes them more sensitive or not, it's unclear. But it still points in this general direction. Then you have new world primates, not the old world primates like us, another whole new world where only the females have color vision, none of the males at all. Now, the one argument for why there's an asexual asymmetry, and I'm not sure if it's right, but it's just a plausible guess, is that there's being sensitive to the modulations of skin color due to hemoglobin and blood helps you with mood and emotion, but also helps you with as a clinical sense. In fact, you know, many of the most important throughout history in medicine, the pallor of the skin, the acute pallor of the skin, is mentioned in the diagnoses. So if mom is able to sense a slightly, a baby who's suckling and is not breathing very well, and you can sense, the faster you can sense that, the better you can deal with the baby's inability to breathe. So that could be one reason why there could be an asymmetry. But it could also be that there's some positive ability to being insensitive to these kinds of signals. Could it be that males who are unable to see them, so for example, there's these studies that show that in combat sports, men who are randomly assigned, they're randomly assigned these people colored shorts, and this is not just in combat sports, it's also been shown in a variety of other sports now. When they're randomly assigned colored uniforms, the people that are randomly assigned red have a small but statistical advantage. And it's the only hypothesis I can think of is, because it just seems crazy, why should the color that you're wearing have any effect on the actual sport? The only hypothesis that seems to begin to potentially make sense is that when you're going against the person who is wearing red, you know, a person would be signaling red in real life to the extent that they're oxygenated. That's what allows a red skin to be shown. So someone who is strong and not winded is going to be able to signal red. And so the more that you fight or battle against this team or this other person and they keep signaling red, you can imagine forget, I can't win. This person is still able to signal this much red. I might as well back down. Could it be that men that are insensitive to that, you know, are willing to fight longer? I don't have these are just vague thoughts in that realm as to what could make a difference. But it does seem to be there's some asymmetry male-female, and trying to fully explain that, understand that, is something I don't have a real explanation for at this point.
So the next power on your list was X-ray vision. So what do you mean when you say that?
Perceptually, if you hold out a finger vertically out in front of you, you'll see and you fixate well beyond. You look out the distance, out the trees far away, you'll see two copies of your finger, not one. If you can't see two copies, it means you have a really dominant eye. But for most of us, you've noticed this since you're a kid that you'll see two copies of your finger, and you'll perceive them each as semi-transparent. That is, you'll see them and you'll see through them. So there's a sense, and that's perceptually, there's a sense in which that's the X-ray vision. Of course, there's no actual X-ray vision here. And so the question is, why, the trick that underlies this simple phenomenon of seeing through your finger is, I claim, what underlies why animals have evolved forward-facing eyes in the first place. So the standard story for why some animals, most animals have sideways-facing eyes. As the basic animal design, you want sideways-facing eyes. And the reason is that the left eye sees the left half of the world, including roughly overhead and below, and the right eye sees the right half of the world. And if you've got two hemispheres that each eye sees, one and the other, you've got the whole sphere around you. You can see everything. Why would animals want to swivel their eyes forward? And you end up with this big binocular region. One thing that you get out of that is three-dimensional vision and that stereoscopy in that part. But, of course, you lose altogether the ability to see the stuff that's behind you. So some of the standard explanations for a century for why we have forward-facing eyes and why animals have moved from sideways-facing eyes is that you get this greater amount of 3D or stereoscopy out front. And one of the big problems theoretically, there's a lot of problems with this. One is that animals, and one of the arguments, and again, there's many different kinds of arguments floating out there, but one of them is that it's helpful if you're a predator. Problem is that most birds are all predatorial, and they all have effectively sideways-facing eyes compared to mammals, and they're all predators. Fish, all sideways-facing eyes relative to any mammals. They're all these sideways-facing eyes, and they do perfectly well. They're all predators. Some of the best examples of forward-facing-eyed animals are the primates, which are at best, opportunistic predators. So, and they're very often not predators at all. So, and theoretically, it's a big trouble. Why should having more stereo up front, more 3D-ness up front, be worth the cost of not seeing at all behind you?
Right.
Why should that be worth it? So my argument was that, no, there's a simple argument here. When you're in the forest and things become leafy, when there's lots of clutter out there in the world, lots of leafy stuff, when your eyes are more widely separated than the leafy stuff that's out in front of you, then you have a new kind of capability, and I call it X-ray vision. It's just that you get to see two different views through the clutter, and it turns out the total amount of stuff that you can see goes up. so that in the if you're really so if you're not in the forest, then you should always have sideways facing eyes no matter how big you are. Now, if you're in the forest, when you're really small, your eyes are so close together that relative to the sizes of the leaves, it's like us trying to look around a Winnebago. You know, you can't see around a Winnebago like you can see around your fingers or even when you hold all your vertical fingers up. But when you become larger, and so small animals in the forest should still have sideways facing eyes. It's only when you become large and in the forest that you get this special probabilistic summation. You get this independence. You get the ability to see more stuff beyond the clutter that's in front of you. And so the prediction is that in forests, the bigger animals should be the ones with forward-facing eyes. Outside of forests, no matter how big you are or small you are, you should have just sideways-facing eyes. And that's what you find when you look across hundreds of different kinds of mammals, across all these mammalian orders. That's the kind of signature pattern that you find.
So that ability, in effect, is wasted on city-dwelling people.
That's right. We could do much better today if we just had sideways-facing eyes. Or we could potentially harness situations where we could better utilize the fact that we have sideways-facing eyes. So the fact that forward-facing eyes, we actually have the ability to see more screens than... In the book, I describe some simple situations where you could have screens of various kinds out in front of you that would almost double the amount of visual field that you have. Just to give you an idea, imagine having a vertical screen that goes right in front of, between you and your computer. You put a vertical screen, and suppose it's got ticker tape going down, and you're a person who's doing stock market analysis. And so it's going directly in front of you, but of course both eyes are occluding, for each eye, it's blocking part of the computer screen behind it. But that's okay, because the other eye gets to see that part of the screen, and so when you look out at the world, at your computer screen, you see two copies of this little vertical screen out in front of you, and you can see each of them is a semi-transparent vertical screen. So you actually now have more than one screen's worth out in front of you. You have more. In fact, you can add more than a single vertical strip of new screen out in front of you. You can add a whole bunch of these screens, and if you rig it right, you can nearly double your visual field size.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be back with more from Mark Changizi, author of The Vision Revolution, after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're talking science and storytelling. Guest host Marie-Claire Shanahan speaks to science journalist and author Deborah Bloom about her national bestseller, The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age New York. The book tells the fascinating story of the way that chemical detectives started a revolution in the investigation of crime. And Desiree Schell talks to Boris Zivkovic, blog editor at Scientific American, about a new event that teaches science through personal stories. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. My guest this week is Mark Changizi, science writer, author, and director of human cognition at the Research Institute 2 AI Labs. We're talking about his book, The Vision Revolution, how the latest research overturns everything we thought we knew about human vision. Now, the next thing on your list, the next power, is something that you call future seeing. Is it true that our brains are literally predicting what will happen a very short time in the future?
Yes, and certainly that's the claim. And it's not in order to see the future. I mean, so strictly speaking, it's trying to see the present. And the problem is, so brains come with delays. When light hits your eye, what your brain would like, and what you would like, is to instantaneously have a perception of what the world's like, with no delay at all. But the problem is it takes, in fact, about a tenth of a second for that perception to occur. And the problem is that the world changes in that tenth of a second. Very often, you change, that is, you're moving forward. And if you're moving forward, a tenth of a second may not sound like a lot, but if you're moving even at just 1 meter per second, which is very slow, that's a tenth of a meter, or 10 centimeters, that you've moved in a tenth of a second. So if you didn't correct for this delay, then anything that you perceived to be within 10 centimeters of you, then by the time you had that perception, you would have already bumped into it or passed it. And if somebody's throwing something at you, or you're actually moving at 10 meters or 5 meters per second, then these are very, even more serious delays. So what the brain will have been selected to do is to take light hits your retina. It wants to generate a perception, but it doesn't want to generate a perception of what it looked like when it hit your retina. It wants to generate a perception of what it will look like a tenth of a second later when the perception occurs. That way your perception will be its best, your brain's best guess of what the world will be like by the time the perception occurs. That is, your future perception will actually be a perception of the present. So this is called perceiving the present. And you need special mechanisms that allow you to, on the basis of the regularities in terms of, that is, the world regularly changes. It's not always random, and especially if you're moving forward. When you move forward, there's strong regularities in how the things in the world, all the shapes in the world, move in your visual field. And we've had millions of years of evolution, and you can quickly, your brain is such that it can quickly learn these changes, such that when you see something, it can say, ah, don't generate a perception of those two things being straight or parallel to one another. Generate a perception of them being like this, because in a tenth of a second they will be like this, and then that way you'll have a perception that's veridical with reality, or truth has truth with reality by the time the perception occurs.
And now that property of vision is a major reason why so-called optical illusions work, right?
One simple way of describing optical illusions in terms of classifying them would be, I think there's two broad kinds. One are the kinds that I think disproportionately end up on YouTube videos or on books in the bookstore, and they're just ambiguity illusions. You see the Necker cube, it's just a line drawing of a cube. You can see it one way or you can see it the other way. And then, of course, there's many much more exciting versions of that. They have the Ames room where you see two people standing side by side in what looks like a room, but one looks like a giant compared to the other. And there's millions of duck and rabbit and old hag and pretty young woman. They're all basically stimuli that are designed to be ambiguous between two possible things in the world. And it's exciting in some sense and fun, but at the end of the day, they're utterly boring. There's nothing that interesting about them because, of course, you're just sending a stimulus to the eyes that are ambiguous between those two things, so your brain is not sure what to think. The more exciting ones are the ones that your eye gets the information, and it's not even ambiguous on your eye, and yet your brain creates a perception that's different. It decides to do something that's not even one of the possible ways the world could be. And the classical illusions that people see in the Psychology 101 courses will have this, and where you have those two lines are vertical and they're parallel to one another, but because of all those spokes, you perceive them as bowing outwards. This is called the herring illusion. You may have seen it. There's a lot of these illusions like this. And you perceive them, this is again, just imagine a bunch of spokes coming out of the middle, and you have two vertical lines on either side. In this case, you perceive the two vertical lines on either side of the spokes to be bowing outwards away from the center, even though they're in fact parallel to one another. You're perceiving something that's not even in the stimulus that's coming. It's not even possible that that's the way the world is. So how do you explain that kind of thing? And there's a whole host of illusions that are like this and not being simple ambiguity. So this is where my theory came in, and it struck me, because you have this delay, you want to try to figure out the way the world is going to change in the next moment. And what I was able to show is that in illusion after illusion, in sort of many of these kinds of illusions, I could show that the stimuli in these illusions are such that they, when you typically receive those sorts of stimuli, it's because you're moving forward. When you move forward in particular, the world moves around you like the optic flow that you get when you're in Star Wars when they go to warp. When they go to warp, you end up with all these radial lines warping out from the center. Well, that actually happens when you move forward because the world moves outwards, and from your retina's point of view, it gets all these little streaks as neural populations of neurons get activated, and they move radially outwards. So when you see an image, even though, and your eyes are actually more like a camera, when you move without the word, you go snapshot, snapshot, snapshot. They have these little fixations. And so when you suddenly look at a picture, this Psychology 101 stimuli, that these illusions, and you have these strong radial lines coming outwards, your brain says, the only time I ecologically normally get these kinds of lines like this is when I'm moving forward towards the center of those lines. And so it thinks that it's moving forward. It thinks it knows where it's going. And then it thinks, once it knows that, it knows how to bend things in the next moment, given that it knows that it's going in that direction.
Right.
And so if you imagine walking through a doorway, you can see what happens. Now, if you're walking through a doorway, you start off as two vertical lines on either side of your direction of motion. But as you get closer, the doorway expands in your visual field. And if you imagine that it's a cathedral doorway, then when you're really close, even though they were parallel to one another when they were far away, when you're really close, at eye level, they've really gone outwards in your visual field. They're on the sides. But if you looked up, the sides of the doorway go towards one another, up into the sky like railroad tracks. But it's now bowed in your visual field so that the parts of the doorway at eye level are more separated than they are above eye level, even though when you were far away from it, they were all effectively nearly the same distance from one another in your visual field. So in the next moment, two vertical lines on either side of your direction of motion really do bow outwards. And so again and again, you can show that the kinds of illusions like this are explainable by virtue of the cues that the cues and the stimulus say where the body's probably going. And your brain is saying, okay, I think I'm moving this way. I need to generate a perception of those things to be distorted in this way, because that's how they will distort in the next moment due to the projective geometry and how it changes if I was moving in that direction. So that turns out to explain the sort of grand unified theory of all these different kinds of illusions that I talk about in the book and in my journal article.
Well, how is your explanation of future seeing different than what's been proposed before?
So the earlier arguments for one of the main arguments is one way to describe it is that your brain is just makes mistakes. Another case to think about is the Ponzo illusion is easier to describe. Mm-hmm. It's not clear how they would explain the illusion that I just described. In the Ponzo illusion, you have what looks like a roadway, two different lines going towards the mountains off in the distance, and there's two logs on the road out in front of you horizontally. And they're the same size logs, just two horizontal lines on the road. And they're the same size, but the one that's higher up or farther down the road, as one would describe it, looks to be to fill more of your visual field. It appears to fill more of your visual field. And so the standard explanation would, in this particular case, although it couldn't explain the previous case that I mentioned, say that the thing that's farther away appears larger because it is larger. Because if it's farther away, that means it's filling up more of the roadway, and thus it must be physically larger. The problem is that it doesn't explain why you should, because they both, in fact, subtend the same angle in your visual field, you should perceive one of them to be larger, physically, and objectively larger in meters, but you should still perceive them as filling the same amount of your visual field, because one of them happens to be far enough, it may be bigger, but it's so far away that it fills the same amount of visual field as something that's smaller and closer. But the problem is that not only do you perceive it to be a bigger, objectively metered thing out there in the world, but you actually perceive it to fill more of your visual field. That can't be explained by that hypothesis. In fact, none of these illusions can be explained by it, because they can't explain why you should be misperceiving the optical projective geometry sort of it, which is what's being misperceived in these illusions.
We have a question from the chat from Space Bats.
Are there any disorders that prevent people from visually predicting the future correctly?
Yeah, I don't know of any offhand. Now, we played with the idea of, so you can imagine this. Imagine someone who's been in a wheelchair, or even bedridden for quite a while. We know that these perceiving the present mechanisms, they're almost certainly innate in the sense that they've been around. Mammals have been moving forward for a long time. It's probably the case that we have special mechanisms that allow us to learn these natural ecological variables very quickly, so they're not just blank slate. But we also know that we can learn new ones. When you play video games, in the beginning it's difficult, but you can get better at it, and the optical variables, the optical transitions in video games are often a little different than the real world. They don't actually follow the proper physics in optical geometries. They do some different things. And so we know that, and we can learn new sports where there's different kinds of perceiving the present that are required, different kind. So if you suddenly sit still for a year at a time because you're bedridden, you might imagine that you're going to start adapting to new kinds of regularities or no longer adapted to the normal world. So the question is, and we haven't done it, are people that are bedridden, do they have lower illusions? That is, are the illusions less magnified amongst those people? So that's a natural question that hasn't been done yet. That would be kind of like a disorder, but it's not a neurological disorder. It's just having sat still for a while. But
now I'm getting a lot of emails and chat room questions sort of in the same area. Now there's a ton more in your book, and especially the chapter on spirit reading, about reading as an evolutionary characteristic, is fascinating. The book seems quite speculative in many ways. So would it be fair to say that from a research perspective, it's easier to actually test the question of how something evolved rather than why?
No. And the reason, the problem with this is that, and there's a general meme and a misunderstanding. People who, so if you're interested in studying a mechanism, one of the things that they do to study mechanisms is, for example, you can come up with a simulation. You do a computational simulation. And this is strife, this business is also strife with just-so stories, as it's called. So the problem with, problem here is that very often hardwired in the hypothesis or this proposed model is all of these very specific things that one has just coded in. And very often there's still 10 or 12 parameters that one can set arbitrarily. And then the game is, okay, we've shown that by virtue of these 20 parameters and these hidden hard-coded parameters that we're not even going to talk about, we can mimic this particular results of this other mechanism. And so that's a good argument that we have something that's close to true. Now, there's better ways to do that, but mechanistic hypotheses are filled with these sorts of just-so stories with lack of any good way of testing. They're really just coming up with just-so stories. They're just fiddling with the parameters until it fits. But, of course, there's better ways to do it. And the same thing, just-so story in the evolutionary side, there's a long history of people in the discussion section of their papers suggesting, well, we think this is just because of such and such. But if you want to make it science, then you have to come up with specific hypotheses that your specific predictions that your hypothesis makes. And so in each case, you have to say, well, what are the predictions? And either they're predictions about the specific nature of the morphology. In the case of color vision, it's that if it really is for sensing skin and the coloration spectral modulations of skin due to blood or due to the emotions and things like this, then, well, it better be optimized for seeing hemoglobin. Let's go figure out how hemoglobin changes and how it changes the function of oxygenation and figure out what the optimal cone sensitivities would be, and then go check to see what the cone sensitivities are. For example, that's a morphological kind of prediction. It also makes predictions about the kinds of animals that is, you can all say, well, animals in this kind of ecology should or shouldn't have it as a function of the kind of ecology they're in. So the ways that you go about testing it are different, you still have to go about, so they're often more phylogenetic predictions or other aspects of the structural predictions, but they have to make predictions and they have to be testable, just like any other part of science.
Have you satisfied yourself that your ideas aren't just so stories?
Oh, yes, yes. Now, I mean, you could still ask whether we need more evidence for any of these things. Sure, any area of science is one that's trying to do that. This is a part of the culture that continues from, and evolutionary psychology especially gets blasted for this, and there's a lot of bad evolutionary psychology hypotheses out there. But the idea that people can't provide evidence for adaptive hypotheses is bonkers. In fact, if one doesn't understand that, one doesn't understand biology. Biology is design. It's the of course all the teleology, all the design can be unpacked by virtue of the fact of it being an unthinking mechanism. Evolution is an unthinking mechanism. But if one doesn't understand that unthinking mechanism of evolution is able to create these massively designed animals that are packed with design, and if one can't identify what those designs and what those functions, why they're structured the way they are, then one can't even do the mechanisms, because you can't point out that a mechanism, you can't understand a mechanism without also saying that mechanism is for doing blah, blah, blah. So if you show up at a Sears, aliens show up at a Sears and they're in the tools section, all across the walls and the floors are all these devices that do stuff. If you're going to understand them, you have to start coming up with hypotheses about what each of those devices, those machines do. And then you can start worrying about, okay, now we understand here's what it probably is for. Humans used it for this kind of thing, and here's the mechanism by which it did it. These are part and parcel of understanding any kind of designed, any kind of complex biological thing.
Well, I think it goes without saying that I am vaguely skeptical. It is in the title of the show, but it was a really interesting book. Thanks very much for being here, Mark.
Thank you.
You'll find links to Mark Changizi and his books on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links to Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, so that you can keep up with show news, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to our program and listen to all the past episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.